This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi tamotu, MPR. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. MPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out mpr.nz for more information.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future.
Today we have with us
Patrick Nolan
and Dawn Nolan.
And I'm Stuart Brooks.
So Patrick, you were talking about your time as a beefeater in the Tower of London.
Right. Well, I'd done all the soldierly things. We'd been to the Antarctic, we'd had a world trip, we decided that we could stay together for the rest of our lives, and so we took the opportunity and went to London. We had a quarter that we slowly furnished, but I had to learn the bits. It was no good sort of being there without earning your pay. I was given a uniform from the quartermaster's store, someone who'd retired and handed in his serviceable uniform.
Roughly the same shape.
Roughly the same shape. So I had this very awkward to get into uniform and a hat. The first thing I had made was a hat, and it was made by equipment that was made in the early 1700s, and Mr. Patey, who was hat maker to the Queen, and I attacked him about being a hat maker, and because I thought all hats are made by milliners, but they're not, as Mr. Patey pointed out. Mr. Nolan, my family have been making hats here in this part of London for the last 7 generations, and not one of these men has ever, ever, ever made a millin. We make hats. And the hats are made out of waxed linen, and they are quite rigid. And if you get one that doesn't fit, you pay for it. You get stinking headaches and things. But I had my own hat made.
What's the difference between a millin and a hat?
I have no idea, but Mr. Okay. Patey, who hat makes for the Queen, makes hats.
Okay.
Yeah. We were given, along with the uniform, a mentor. And I would stand out there with my mentor, and people would come along, and the pictures were easy. I could manage that. Thumb in the belt, chest out. And tons of teeth. But the questions were very difficult because I didn't know a darn thing about it. And I would defer to my colleague. But one of the first things I learned was you never, ever use slang. Because slang can get you into more trouble trying to talk your way out of it than ever it was by using it in the first place. So, I would listen to the questions. I was doing a lot of reading at night, of course. Start with the guidebooks. And then I was given a script that I had to learn word for word. It was, a 6-stop tour of the Tower of London. And once I'd started learning it, it was difficult. It was so, so difficult. And once I'd started learning it, then my mentor and I would be out from 6:30 to 7:30 every morning, and I would be standing on the blocks that we used to talk on, concrete blocks or a wooden block, and I would stand on this and roar out. It was part of building up your voice. Roar out the bits I'd learned, followed by do it again.
One of the problems with the thing was not just that it was history that wasn't familiar, but there is a difference between the way we speak English and the way the English speak English.
As you are well aware. Yeah.
The phraseology, sentences are constructed differently.
We shift, you move. I'm just looking.
And you were the first non-English,
non-British, non-British servicemen ever
as a beef eater.
Yes, non-British army order. Or British services.
Yeah.
The first colonial.
We started in 1826. The numbering system started when the Duke of Wellington, who was then constable, said that yeoman warders would be gallant, meritorious and long-serving sergeants of our army. And from that, of course, we've had the Air Force, who came from the Royal Flying Corps, which was army, and they let marines in, and marines are soldiers who muck about in boats. And we don't have sailors because they can't be trusted.
Don't they swear allegiance to the
Board of the Admiralty? Yeah. And we swear an oath to the Queen.
Ah.
Yeah. So that's how that bit went on. But anyway, with these with the words, the story, and everybody's hanging on your very coattails to see whether I did mine faster than you did. Or one chap took about 18 months to learn it. You know, it starts off, "Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Her Majesty's Royal Palace and Fortress, the Tower of London. Come with me for the next hour or so, and I will take you on a tour of the tower, pointing out the more interesting places, telling you of interesting people and other such tales of derring-do. And finishing with, and that concludes my tour, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming around with me. If there are any questions, please ask my colleagues who are out there."
59 minutes start to finish.
Between 58 and 61 minutes. And it must, because there is a person behind you and there's a person in front of you, and we all must finish in the chapel. So it's a... Hey, we're all retired sergeants, Major, and if you can't get it right, nobody can. So that basically is it. When you finish that, you're invited to St. James's Palace at your own expense. Your wife may go as camp follower, and you swear an oath, and the oath is so complicated and
archaic.
Oh, and in whomsoever lieth, and phrases that, you know, just roll off the tongue. And when I first went in, I was number 351 since 1826. 351, Yeoman Warder Patrick Nolan. And after I swore this oath, I walked out, and I was a bit different. I was 351, Yeoman Warder Patrick Nolan, Yeoman of the Guard and Extraordinary Bodyguard to the Sovereign of Her Majesty's Royal Palace and Fortress, the Tower of London, .com.nz. Yep, I was an extraordinary member of the Yeoman of the Guard, who are different. We are yeoman warders, we live and work in the Tower of London, but through this oath we became part of the Sovereign's bodyguard. We are extraordinary members of his bodyguard, and it gives us the right to wear that scarlet uniform.
Now, and you can keep that afterwards?
No.
But the one that you have on display?
Yes.
Fell into the suitcase by mistake when we were being packed.
Do we need to take this any further?
No, not at all.
You could have
There's
a
always
replica.
One. These are like the people who ask, did Anne Boleyn write her name on the wall before or after she had her head cut off?
Or the one that said, one side of the river is the bridge on.
How often do people get their heads cut off? You know, once is enough for most people.
Well, I was actually just thinking, the fact that you had to learn everything perfectly, but as long as you said something confidently,
no.
All those people who are trailing behind you would probably be none the wiser.
No, they wouldn't. That's to qualify.
Yes,
and once you've done it, most questions can be answered within that, those 30-odd pages. Most questions can be answered. You can't afford to tell porkies, because people ask questions because they want to know the answer, or they know a little bit about it and they want their knowledge expanded, or they know an awful lot about it and want to know what you know about it. And that can be a little bit difficult.
And American college kids, girls especially, know everything.
Yeah.
And if they've seen it on TV or in the movies, like Braveheart, you cannot you just can't argue with them, can you? Because
and now the Crown. Oh my God.
Sterling needs Mel Gibson on a plinth. And they got him. People come down and say, I want to light this incense on the place where you,
English,
murdered William Wallace. And you say, well, you take this to your taxi and ask him to take you down to Billingsgate Fish
Bart's
Market.
Hospital.
No?
Bart's Hospital.
By Bart's Hospital. There's a thing about as big as that television on the wall that is on the stone wall that said, near this place, William Wallace, the Scottish terrorist, was executed by hang, drawing and quartering on such and such a date. And it's been up there for 300 or 400 years.
And it's covered in little bits of tartan ribbon.
And he wasn't executed in the tower, he was executed down nearby. But
they saw it on Braveheart and they know.
Yeah, a little bit of knowledge is dangerous, and you say, well, you are not right, I am right, you are wrong, and they're not prepared to. So you can show them books, but their knowledge is based on what they have seen and what they have heard, and that is more accurate than any boring old retired soldier.
How large were the groups that you'd take round?
Oh,
there's a maximum number that they take.
Well, it's just as long as your yell can carry, because if your yell can't carry, the people on the fringes just drift away.
They don't allocate, you're in this group starting at this time.
No. You may join a tour.
Okay. There's the beef eaters just going round in sequence, and whoever's around can just tag on wherever they want. Okay.
Yeah. So,
and you don't have to follow them for the whole tour. You can just join in for...
They run every half hour.
Okay.
Yeah. And they start at 25 minutes. They're advertised on the half hour and on the hour, but they start at 25 and 5.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they run all through the summer when it gets really, really hot. And it's very tiring because there's all the traffic. There's 5 traffic lights around the tower, and emergency vehicles have to sound their siren at every traffic light. There's planes overhead, there's boats
every
on the
minute,
river.
There's a jumbo jet going over the top.
Mm.
You've got all the boats on the Thames.
Yeah.
And if they're turning to port, they go toot, toot. And if they're turning to starboard, they blow it 5 times.
Mm-hmm.
You've got cops chasing the robbers in the police fizz boats up and down the river. You've got people saying, and there, ladies and gentlemen, is the
Tower of
London with the jolly old beef eaters. Aren't they lovely old fellows? Wave to the beef eater. Hello, beefy. And you say, Mick, I'm going to kill you when you come in for a beer tonight, you bastard. Because Mick, the boat is... He is the boyfriend of one of the yeoman warder's daughters. And Mick runs a boat and he does the best boat tour.
Anyway,
and
to
he's
get
fun.
Back to the tower.
Anyway, getting back
but
to
in the
tower.
Summer, they'll do the, 4 tours a day?
Yeah, 3.
And it's over 30 degrees, and they're in their uniforms, and it's hot, and they've been surrounded by people.
You're wearing the blue ones.
You finish, you do an hour tour, and then you have an hour's break, and you get in at night absolutely shattered, and your uniform is dripping wet. And they'd change, they wear a T-shirt underneath the uniform. And if you have a four T-shirt day, you know it's been hot and hard.
Now, you said there's a blue uniform, and then there's the red one.
Ceremonial, the red one.
Yeah.
That, by being sworn in as the bodyguard, gives us the right to wear that scarlet uniform.
Yeah.
That stems back from 1485, when the master of the king's bodyguard was a prisoner in the Tower. And he was well taken with the way the yeoman warders did their work and looked after prisoners. And he said, if there's anything I can do for you blokes when I get out, I'm your man, give us a yell. And the yeoman warders approached him in the body, and they said, can we wear the uniform of your men, the bodyguard? He approached the king gave his assent or consent, and as a consequence, by swearing that oath, we are approved to wear the scarlet. 1848, Queen Victoria, under the authority of Queen Victoria, the Duke of Wellington said that we could wear the blue uniform, which is of similar pattern. John Peel, the cop, policeman. Do you ken?
John Peel. The song's John Peel. It was Robert Peel who established the police force.
The Peelers,
yeah. Bobby.
Yes.
Bobby. Yeah, and he gave us the right, he designed the blue uniform that we wear. It's a lot more economical.
Yeah, yeah. Because I think you mentioned that the red uniform is very thick, it's very expensive to make, very complex.
It's got 24 karat gold embroidery on it.
And it's all hand done.
Yeah, and what's it weigh?
It's like a soldier, you're never asking how heavy his pack is. Because if you knew him, you wouldn't be able to pick it up.
You always used to say it's about 16 kilos fully dressed.
I can't remember, I'm not going to weigh it, it's just a point of honour.
Yeah, but it's actually quite thick material. It's not just
very, it's quilted.
Yeah.
No, to be able to take a sword cut. You like the horses. The horses used to have the padding, and they had that big, long, whiskery thing. Well, that will, in fact, stop a sword cut. Those whiskers that the Blues and Royals or one of those household cavalry, their horses, drum horses, have them. They have like a horse's tail under their chin, tied off the bottom of the bridle, and that will, in fact, stop a sword cut. Like silk, I suppose. It's very difficult to cut silk.
I went to the Tower in 1966 and I can't remember a thing.
No, that's terrible. I'll get my uniform out, but you can't.
Can't
see it on the wires. I do, in fact, have the perfect face for radio.
And for television, you'd be all right.
Oh, I think not.
With your group, did they tend to be in sort of nationalities? So you'd have a group of Americans, group of Japanese,
One of my colleagues was a Scot. He had soldiered as a boy soldier right through his career with the Scottish Regiment. So he didn't speak English, as didn't the man Geordie.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
He was from Newcastle, and he nor his wife spoke English. They spoke a sort of a dialect.
Partly that, partly accent, but yeah.
We aye, man, bring the brush and paint and do some painting.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that I believe is part English. I just learnt it by rote.
But
some people
on
have
occasion,
trouble with
someone
the accents.
Would ask for an English speaking tour after listening to them.
Well, just a minute. You said you had to learn to speak the proper way so that the English could understand.
I spoke common New Zealand, but I made a point of finishing my words.
Ah, yes.
And if I finish my words and slow down the way we talk a bit, then it's okay. No, you have no problem being understood.
Okay.
But these blokes were English speaking English.
Yes, but regional accents can be quite strong. In fact, if you grow up in, or when I was growing up in a British city, you can almost tell what part of a city or what part of a street someone lived in from the way they spoke.
No, but English is a very... Thank God I was brought up speaking English. Because I would hate to be a foreigner trying to understand the English way of English, the way it's worded. The verbs in most languages, apart from English, the verbs and the nouns are transposed. The girl with the guidebook looking for the green tower, when in fact she's standing on the tower green. That can be a bit difficult.
Actually, talking about languages, we were breeding Somali kittens, and our cats became a bit famous, and a Japanese cat magazine came to interview us in Japanese. They took some fantastic photos, didn't they? The cats played up for all they were worth. There's a camera, look huge. And then forever after, when the magazine was published, they sent us a copy along with a translation, and we were getting Japanese tourists wanted to meet Chloe.
Chloe, the cat. Picture.
Oh,
there's a picture of me.
Oh, was it sort of a beef eater with a cat? You know, there was that.
Yeah. Where's Corey? Because they're not too good on L's.
Yes.
But the article was about cats
cat
and me.
So I'd have to sort of...
Cats in the Tower was the article, and it was pretty good. Our cats sort of... They used to go up and play with the tourists.
Now, Dawn, for Pat to be a beef eater, he had to be married. So you were living in the Tower. Did that mean that you had a special role?
No, it meant that I had to do what I'd normally do in New Zealand. Most of the wives worked because there wasn't a lot of entertainment in the Tower. London was expensive. A lot of the couples had mortgages on houses outside the Tower. They'd bought them and they would be paying them off till they retired at whatever, 65, 60. So the wives went to work. Well, I thought I'd be tourist. And I was doing quite well, actually, until one of the old biddies said, well, are you going to get a job? I said, if I could get one 10 to 2, 3 days a week, I'd think about it. Well, it took her 20 minutes to find me a job. And it was in a tobacconist, which was handy because I learnt the money and the language. And then I went to a tourist spot on town.
Blown up first. Got blown up.
Well, no, we had a few... bomb scares.
Well, the bomb went off just around the corner.
And
the big one in Leadenhall.
Yeah.
Yeah, that one was just around from
50 yards from where Dawn worked.
But my place of work was not touched. There'd be a building with alternate on a diagonal. Windows would be broken on one side. Every window on another side, nothing on the other two sides. Bomb blast was strange. But then I went to Tower Hill Pageant in the finance office there, and they went into bankruptcy, so I got a job in the Tower with the Royal Regiment of Fusiliers.
God bless every
one. And my boss was the Deputy Chairman, Army Youth Rugby. And my brother was an All Black, so I was a natural. I didn't understand rugby, but there was a connection there, so I got the job. it was good, because I'd... You know, with the military background.
So your brother had been an All Black?
Yes, yeah, Manawa too. He was Doug Rollison.
Okay.
And
back when Manawa too had the shield, speaking as an old bunny for boy. Took it from Auckland too.
Yeah, and Doug had no recollection of it because he got stiff-armed in the first 30 seconds. He scored a try, kicked a conversion, he got a drop kick and a penalty. And when he was in the showers, he said, is the game over? How did we do?
He was concussed. Different these days, isn't it?
He has no recollection of the game.
Yeah.
But even the game of rugby's changed.
Yeah.
If you look at a game of first class rugby from, say, the 80s, 70s or 80s, with them going over the top and rucking people and rucking the ball back, and the game was faster and there were less people hurt because they weren't hitting the ruck so fast, and the people weren't physically engineered to play the rugby they do now. There are forwards. Well, I was a reasonably quick winger when I played, and there are tight head props who would take 20 yards off me over 40.
But instead of having sports scientists train them, one of Doug's mates, his dad had a rubbish collection business in Wellington, and he'd hire the boys, and they'd run up and down the hills of Wellington collecting rubbish bins.
Chucking rubbish on the that's
their training session.
Yeah.
And that gave them a fitness that the players now, I don't think they've got the same core toughness that the boys then. They had to toughen up. So many of them, Colin Meads and him, they worked physically hard, and rugby was secondary. Now they're rugby
professional
first.
Made a big difference.
Someone said to Colin Meads, "What do you think of these young people not shaving before a match?" And he said, "What, so they can look tough?" And the young bloke said, "Yeah, that's right." And Colin said, "Well, in my day, we just went out on the field. We had a shave, went out on the field, and we were tough." And that sums up the attitude. So now we've gone from cadets to
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.